We mark every active file as deleted, says Casey. Then the virus activates. It doesn't do anything because it sees no active files to overwrite. She looks at Devin, who seems skeptical. And then what? He asks. At some point, we have to recover those files, right? I mean, that's the whole point. To save those files, to save all that data. So when we recover them, when we unmark them and make them active again, the virus just overwrites them then. It happens later instead of sooner, but it still happens. We're just delaying the inevitable. I look around at everyone in the room, unwilling to let this go. I have the tiniest fraction of their knowledge, but the more I interact with them, the more I think that might be an advantage. They are way too engulfed in the trees to see the forest. Are you sure, I ask. After the virus does its job, are we sure it doesn't go back to sleep? Or die? Or whatever? I asked you that before, and you responded by asking what happens to a cancer cell after the host body dies. Use my analogy instead. The assassin walks into the room, ready to kill everybody, and finds them all dead. Does the assassin leave, thinking his job is already accomplished? Or does he wait around forever just in case somebody wakes up? Casey, thinking it over, nodding. He's right, she says to Kevin. We don't know. In every model we've run, the virus overwrote the core operating files and killed the computer. We never asked ourselves what happens to the virus afterward. We've never run a model where the computer survives afterward. We can't say for certain the virus would remain active. But why wouldn't it remain active? Asked Devin. I can't imagine Nina would have programmed the Suleiman virus to stop at any point, would she? All eyes turned to Augie, his hands stuffed in his pockets, eyes in a focused squint, peering off into some point in the present or the past. I can all but hear the tick of the clock. I want to grab him and shake him, but he's working this through. When his mouth opens, everyone in the room seems to lean toward him.
I think your plan is possible. Certainly worth trying on a trial run.
I check my watch. 18 minutes have passed since I made my offer of a pardon. No attempts to contact me. Why not? It's the deal of a lifetime.
Let's run a test right now, says Casey.
Devin folds his arms, not looking convinced.
What? I ask him. This isn't going to work, he says, and we're wasting time we don't have.
Chapter 92. A group of scraggly, frumpy, frazzled computer experts stares at the smart board in the room as Devin completes his preparations for the test run. Okay, says Devin, hovering over the keyboard of one of the test computers. Every single file on this computer has been marked as deleted. Even the core operating files. You can delete the core operating files and still run the computer? Normally, no, he says, but what we did was... Never mind, I don't care, I say. So, let's do it. Activate the virus. I'll delete the virus, which should activate it. I turn to the smart board as Devin performs one of the few things that even a dinosaur like me could do, clicking on the Suleiman.exe file and hitting delete. Nothing happens. Okay, it resisted my deletion, says Devin. It triggered the activation process.
Devin, the virus is active, Mr. President, says Casey, translating, the assassin has entered the room.
A series of files pops up on the screen, just like the random files they showed me before, a series of boxes, the properties in a group of descending rows for each file.
It's not overwriting them, says Casey.
The assassin hasn't found anyone to kill yet. So far, so good. I turn to Casey. You said it took about 20 minutes to look for all the files. So we have 20...
No, she says.
I said it took 20 minutes to overwrite them all, one by one. But it finds them much quicker. It... Here! Devin works the keyboard, popping up an image of the Suleiman virus. Completing scan. 62%. She's right, it's moving much faster. 70%, 80%. I close my eyes, open them, look at the smart board. Scan completed. Number of files located, 0.
Okay, says Devin. So it didn't overwrite anything. Not a single file affected. Now let's see if the assassin will leave the room. Mission accomplished, I say. Augie, who has remained quiet in the corner, tapping his foot, handcuffing Chen, chimes in.
We should delete the virus now. Again, now that it has performed its function, it might not resist.
Or it might reactivate it, says Devin. Wake it back up, he says to me.
If that happens, says Augie, then we will run the model again, but not delete it.
I'm suddenly realizing why every move they make has consequences, why every tactic they've employed is subject to multiple iterations, why it was necessary to have so many test computers, so many trials. Devin says, we should do it my way first. There's a better chance of the virus coexisting with the... An argument erupts in the room in multiple languages. Everyone has an opinion. I raise my hand and shout above the din. Hey! Hey! Do it Augie's way, I say. Delete the virus again. See what happens. I nod at Devin. Do it. Okay, he says. On the smart screen, I watch Devin move the cursor over the only active file in the entire computer, the Suleiman.exe virus. Then he hits delete. The icon disappears. A collective exhalation of air escapes from the room, as the world's foremost cyber ops experts gasp in wonder at the empty screen.
Holy shit, Casey blurts out. You know how many times we've tried to erase that stupid thing?
About 500.
That is literally the first time that's happened.
The wicked witch is dead, Devin says. He furiously works the computer screen changing so fast I can't look at it.
The wicked witch is dead!
I temper my enthusiasm, suppress a wave of relief. We're not there yet. Recover all the other files, says Casey. Let's see if the assassin really has left the room. Okay, we're recovering all marked as deleted files, says Devin. His finger strokes like a little animal chirps as he feverishly works to recover the files. Except the virus, of course. I turn away, unable to look. The room is silent. I glance at my phone to check the time. 28 minutes have passed since I made the offer of a pardon. Nobody has called. I don't understand it. I didn't expect anyone to confess on the spot, of course. No doubt it would be a big moment, admitting to something like this, a monumental thing, the biggest moment in a person's life. They'd need a few minutes to consider it. But consider it they would. The tremendous chance of being caught committing treason against America and the horrific consequences it would bring, prison, disgrace, ruin for the family. And here I'm offering a free pass, as free a pass as I could possibly offer. Not just avoiding prison or the death penalty, but avoiding infamy, too. I promise to keep this classified. Nobody would ever know what the traitor did. If they got paid off, which presumably they did, they could keep the money, too. No prison, no disgrace, no forfeiture. Why would anyone turn down that offer? Does no one believe me? Mr. President, says Devin. I turn to him. He nods to the screen. A bunch of files are pulled up, their properties listed in those descending rows. No zeros, I say.
No zeros, says Devin.
The files are recovered and active, and the virus isn't touching them.
Yes! Casey punches a fist in the air. We tricked the freaking virus!
Everyone is hugging, high-fiving, releasing hours of frustration. See? I knew this was a good idea, Devin jokes. And my phone buzzes in my hand. Get ready to do this for real, I shout at Devin, at Casey, at all of them. Get set up on the Pentagon server.
Yes, sir.
How long, guys? Minutes?
A few minutes, says Casey. Maybe 20, 30, it will take us time.
Hurry. If I'm not standing here when you're ready, find me. Then I leave the room to answer my phone. It's been 29 minutes since I offered the pardon. Whoever it is used nearly every second of the 30 minutes. I remove my phone from my pocket and look at the face, the caller ID. FBI Liz, it reads. Chapter 93. In the hallway outside the war room, I answer a call from someone I had already ruled out of suspicion.
Mr. President?
Director Greenfield, I say.
We just unlocked Nina's second phone, she says, the one we found in the back of the van.
That's great, right?
Let's hope. We're downloading everything right now. We'll have it for you soon.
Why would Nina have two phones? I have no idea. There has to be something good on that phone, Liz.
It's certainly possible, sir.
There has to be, I say, looking at my watch. 31 minutes have now passed. My offer of a pardon has expired, without a word from anyone.
Chapter 94. High up in the white pine tree, Bach listens and waits, the scope of the rifle trained on the rear of the house through the branches.
Where is it?
She wonders.
Where is the helicopter?
She missed her chance. That was him. She is certain now. The scrawny, scraggly-haired man who passed into the cabin after the president. Had she even a few more seconds to confirm, that man would be dead now, and she would be on a plane. But Ranko's words during that summer, those 3 months that he taught her,
a missed shot is far worse than no shot.
Caution was the better play. He might have come back out sometime over the last several hours, giving her another chance. The fact that he did not, that he has not re-emerged from the cabin, does not render her decision at the time unreasonable or even wrong. Playing gently through her earbuds is the Gavotte in D major, performed by Wilhelm Friedemann Herzog some 12 years ago, a tutorial for Suzuki students. It is by no means her favorite of Johann Sebastian's work. Truth be told, she never particularly cared for the piece, and would rather hear it played with a full ensemble than as a violin solo. But she cannot let go of the piece. She remembers playing it on her mother's violin, at first so choppy and awkward, ripening with time, maturing from a series of notes to something graceful and moving. Her mother hovering over her, gently instructing her, correcting every stroke.
Bow distribution. Now big!
First one strong. Strong, little, little. Do it again. Balance your bow, Draga. Slow down your fingers, but not the bow. Not the bow. Here, Draga, let me show you.
Her mother taking the violin herself, playing the gavotte from memory, her confidence and passion, losing herself in the music, shutting out the bombs and artillery fire outside, the house safe within the gentle spell of the music. Her brother, so much more talented on the violin, not only because he is 2 years older with 2 more years instruction, but also because it came so effortlessly to him, as if it were an extension of him and not a separate musical instrument, as if producing beautiful music was as natural as speaking or breathing. For him, a violin. For her, a rifle. Yes, a rifle. One last time. She checks her watch. It's time. It's past time. Why has nothing happened? Where is the helicopter?
Chapter 95. I can't thank you enough, I say to Chancellor Jürgen Richter. Well, I am disappointed by our failure in Berlin. It wasn't your failure. He knew you were coming. Then I add, using his first name, a rare thing with him, a man of such formality. Jürgen, your influence on NATO will be critical if it comes to that. Yes. He gives a grave nod. He knows that this is the principal reason I brought him here, to look him squarely in the eye and make sure that our NATO partners will stand with the United States should a military conflict become necessary. Article 5, the commitment of NATO itself, will be tested as never before if the traditional roles are reversed and the world's greatest superpower is the one that needs assistance in what could easily turn into World War III. Noya. I give her a long hug, enjoying the comfort of her warm embrace.
I could stay, Johnny, she whispers in my ear.
I pull back. No, it's already past 7. I've already kept you longer than I planned. If this happens, if the worst, I don't want to be responsible for your safety, and you'll want to be back home anyway. She doesn't argue. She knows I'm right. If the virus activates and does the worst of what we fear, the reverberations will be felt around the world. These leaders will want to be home when that happens.
My experts could stay, she offers.
I shake my head. They've done all they can do. My people are doing their work on the Pentagon server now, and we have to keep that work internal, as you can imagine.
Of course.
I shrug. Besides, this is it, Noya. This is our last chance to stop the virus. She takes my hand in hers, wrapping her delicate, wrinkled hands around mine.
Israel has no greater friend, she says, and I have no greater friend.
The best decision I made was bringing Noya here today. Without my aides here with me, I felt her presence and guidance to be a comfort beyond description. But in the end, no number of aides or advice can change the fact that this all comes down to me. This is happening on my watch. This is my responsibility. Mr. Prime Minister, I say, shaking the hand of Ivan Volkov.
Mr. President, I trust our experts have been of assistance.
They have, yes. Please convey my gratitude to President Chernikov. As far as my people can tell, the Russian techs were on the up and up. At a minimum, Casey and Devin saw no signs that they were trying to sabotage the process, but that doesn't mean they couldn't have withheld something. There's no way to know.
My experts tell me that your plan to stop the virus could be successful, says Volkov. We are most hopeful this is so.
I wait for the trace of a smirk, a sense of irony from the stone-faced, cold-blooded man. Everyone should be hopeful, I say, because if we're hurt, everyone's hurt. But the people responsible for this should be the most worried, Mr. Prime Minister, because the United States will retaliate against anyone responsible, and I'm assured by our NATO allies that they will stand with us. He nods the furrowed brow, the look of deep concern.
In the coming days, he says, leaders will have to make decisions deliberately and cautiously.
In the coming days, I say, we will find out who are America's friends and who are America's enemies. Nobody will want to be an enemy. With that, Volkov takes his leave. The three leaders, their aides, and their computer experts walk down the back stairs. A Marine helicopter lands on the helipad in the backyard, preparing to whisk them away.
Chapter 96. Here we go. From her perch in the white pine, Bach looks through the scope of her rifle at the backyard. Breathe. Relax. Aim. Squeeze. The military helicopter, using sound suppression that reduces the roar of the rotating blades to a gentle whisper, sets down on the pad. The cabin door opens. She steels herself. The leaders walk out of the cabin, illuminated by the porch lights. She marks each of them as they exit, sees the opportunity for clean shots to the head. The Israeli Prime Minister. The German Chancellor. The Russian Prime Minister. Others walking out too. She scans their faces. 1 second, that's all she will need now that she's ready. Breathe. Relax. Aim. Squeeze. A dark-haired man. Her finger caresses the trigger. Negative. Adrenaline surging through her body. This is it, and she's done forever. Long-haired man. No, not her target. The cabin door remains open, and then it closes. Yeviga, she curses to herself. He never came out. He's still inside.
The helicopter lifts. She feels the rush of air as the helicopter rises and angles away, quickly disappearing in relative silence. He won't leave the cabin. He won't come to them. So they'll have to go to him. She sets down her rifle and lifts her binoculars. U.S. Secret Service remaining on the lawn, manning the back porch as well. They have laid down flares around the perimeter of the yard to enhance the lighting in the dark. What happens next will be much riskier.
Team one in position,
she hears in her ear.
Team two in position.
And much bloodier.
Chapter 97. Hurry, I say to Devin and Casey in the basement, while Devin, plugged into the Pentagon systems, works to mark all Pentagon files as deleted, realizing, as I say it, that he's going as fast as he can and that my badgering doesn't help matters. My phone buzzes. Liz, I say, answering it.
Mr. President, we downloaded the contents of Nina's second phone. You need to see them right away.
Okay. How?
I'll send them straight to your phone right now.
Everything? What am I looking for?
There was only one thing she ever used that phone for, Liz says. Just one thing. She was using a burner phone and texting with another burner. Nina was communicating with our insider, Mr. President. She was text messaging with our traitor.
My blood goes cold. There was always a small part of me that wanted to believe that there was no traitor, that Nina and Augie had learned the code word Dark Ages some other way, that none of my people was capable of doing this. Tell me who, Liz, I say, a tremble in my voice. Who did it?
No name, sir. I just sent it.
I'll read it and call you back. I end the call. Devin, Casey, I call out. I'm going into the communications room. The moment you're ready, you call out to me.
Yes, sir.
My phone beeps an instant later, a message from Liz. There is a document attached, which I open as I head into the communications room. Alex behind me. The document displays as a transcript. The participants in the communication designated as either Nina or U/C for unknown caller. I prefer traitor or Judas or Benedict Arnold. And broken down by date and time. The first text message comes from the unknown caller on May 4th. That was a Friday. That was the day after I returned from my European trip, the day after the news broke that the United States had thwarted an assassination attempt on Süleyman Jindoric and that the mother of a dead CIA operative was demanding answers. I look at the first grouping of texts from May 4th and notice the location of the unknown caller. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The text messages came from the White House. Whoever it is, communicated from within the walls of the White House. It's unfathomable. I put that aside and start reading. Friday, May 4th. Unknown caller, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Nina, location unknown. All times Eastern Standard Time. Unknown caller, 7:52 a.m. I read your note, obviously. Who are you, and how do I know this is serious? Nina, 7:58 a.m. You know I'm real. How else would I know the precise moment, down to the second, that the virus appeared on your Pentagon server? Nina, 8:29 a.m. No response. You have nothing to say? Nina, 9:02 a.m. You don't believe me? Fine. Then watch your country go down in flames. Instead of being hero, you can explain to the POTUS that you could have stopped this, but didn't. From hero to goat emoji. So sad. Nina, 9:43 a.m. Why would I lie about this? What do you have to lose? Why are you ignoring me? I think back to the timing. We had a meeting of the national security team that morning. My inner circle, all in the White House. Whoever this is was texting from that meeting. I keep reading. Nina continues to pursue the unknown caller. Nina, 9:54 a.m. I guess you don't want to be the hero, then just bury head in sand and pretend like I don't exist. See no evil, hear no evil, say no evil emojis. Nina, 9:59 a.m. 7 flame emojis. Nina, 10:09 a.m. Maybe you will believe me after Toronto. Toronto, right. That Friday was the day the Toronto subway system screeched to a halt, shut down entirely by a computer virus that we assumed was the work of the Sons of Jihad. It happened during the evening rush hour. Nina was texting about it that morning, before it happened, just as she told me about the helicopter crash in Dubai before it happened. So that explains how this came about, at least. I've been wondering how this whole thing began, how a cyber terrorist and a member of my national security team ever got acquainted in the first place. Nina initiated the conversation. She somehow got word to the Judas in our inner circle. But whoever that insider is, why didn't he or she just tell me right away? The moment that note was received, why not tell me about it? Why keep it a secret? How differently this all could have turned out if the insider had just come to me at that point. I scroll down. That's it for May 4th. The next communication is the following day, Saturday, May 5th, in the morning. Again, the unknown caller texting from the White House. Smart, I realize. The traitor recognized that his or her location might be traced all the way down to the street address, to 1600 Pennsylvania, and made sure to be in the presence of other high-level security officials at that time, hiding within the inner circle. Cautious. Smart. I read, Saturday, May 5th, unknown caller, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Nina, location unknown, all times Eastern Standard Time. Unknown caller, 10:40 a.m. So you're serious. Is that what you're going to do to our military systems? What you did to the Toronto subway last night? Nina, 10:58 a.m. That times a million. I have your attention now. Unknown caller, 10:59 a.m. Yes, I believe you now. You can stop this virus? Nina, 11:01. Yes, I can tell you how to stop it. Unknown caller, 11:02. Telling me wouldn't help. I don't know enough about computers. Nina, 11:05 a.m. You don't need to know anything. I will tell you what you need, simple, simple. Unknown caller, 11:24 a.m. Then turn yourself in. Go to the nearest U.S. embassy. Nina, 11:25 a.m. And go straight to Gitmo. No thanks. Unknown caller, 11:28 a.m. Then just tell me how to stop the virus. Nina, 11:31 a.m. Give up my leverage? That's the only reason you will give me amnesty. If I go first and tell you how to stop the virus, how do I know you will keep up your end of the deal? No, sorry, that's one thing I won't do. Never. Unknown caller, 11:34 a.m. Then I can't help you. You have to do this yourself. Nina, 11:36 a.m. Why can't you help me? Unknown caller, 11:49 a.m. Because I'm in trouble now. You told me about Toronto yesterday before it happened, and I didn't say anything or tell anyone. Nina, 11:51 a.m. Why didn't you tell anyone? Unknown caller, 11:55 a.m. I didn't believe you. And have you read the news? The president is getting crucified just for calling Suleiman. And here I am texting with someone who works with him. I made a mistake, but I can't do anything about that now. But I believe you. Let me figure this out, okay? Just wait to hear from me, okay? Do we have time for that? When does the virus strike? Nina, 11:57 a.m. In 1 week. I will give you till tomorrow, no longer. That's the end of the Saturday, May 5th exchange. My mind is racing, trying to make sense of this. So this wasn't some long-standing treasonous plan? It wasn't blackmail. It wasn't money. Just a mistake in judgment? One bad decision piled on top of another, and suddenly we're in this mess? The next text comes from our Benedict Arnold, again from the White House, the following morning, Sunday, May 6th. Unknown caller, 7:04 a.m. I have an idea of how we can do this while keeping me out of it. Are you close to Paris?
Chapter 98. A white van, bearing the logo of Lee's Boats and Docks, turns off the Virginia County Highway onto a gravel road. Up ahead, a barrier has been erected with a sign attached to it that reads, "Private property, no trespassing." Beyond it, two black SUVs are parked perpendicular to the road. The driver of the van, who goes by Lotzik, stops the van and looks in the rearview mirror at the eight men in the rear compartment, all dressed in body armor. Four of them armed with AK-47s. The other four manning shoulder-launched assault weapons loaded with armor-penetrating rockets.
"If I take off my hat," he says, reminding them of the signal.
Lodzik gets out of the car, looking the part of a lake guy, wearing a hat with a ripped visor, a flannel shirt, and torn jeans. He approaches the SUVs at the barricade, raising a hand as if posing a question.
"Hello," he says. "You fellas know how I find County Road 20.
No answer. The windows of the SUVs are tinted, so he can't see inside.
"Anyone there?" he asks.
He asks again and again. It's what they thought. Nobody's occupying those SUVs. The Secret Service is spread too thin, especially with the other security now flying off in a Marine helicopter. So Lotzik doesn't remove his cap, and the gunners don't spill out to fire their rockets at the convoy. Good. They'll need them for the cabin. Lotzik returns to the car and nods at the men.
"Looks all clear to the cabin," he says. "Hold on."
He drops the gear into reverse and backs up to the end of the gravel road. Then he stops, puts the gear in drive, and floors the gas pedal, hurtling the van toward the barricade. Moments later, a speedboat drifts slowly toward the small bay where Secret Service agents sit in a boat, well lit at dusk. Unlike Team 1's van, penetrating from the north, the boat only contains four men, the opportunity for concealment being far less. Two men stand at the bow of the boat. At their feet on the deck, the other two men, lying prone, and four AK-74 assault rifles fitted with underbarrel grenade launchers.
"Stop your boat!" the Secret Service agent calls out through a megaphone. "This is restricted water!"
The leader, a man named Hamid, cups his hand and yells toward the agents.
"Can you tow us ashore? Our engine's dead! Turn your boat around!"
Hamid opens his arms.
"I can't! Engine's dead!"
The man standing next to Hamid, his head turned downward only slightly, says to the men at his feet, "On my command."
"Then drop anchor and we will send for help. You want me to? Do not advance. Drop anchor now."
The agents on the boat scramble, one heading to each side of the boat, one to the bow, each of them yanking off tarps, exposing mounted machine guns.
"Now,"
whispers Hamid, reaching down for one of the weapons. The hidden men jump to their feet with their AK-74s, their grenade launchers, and open fire on the Secret Service.
Chapter 99. In the communications room, reading the text messages between Nina and our Benedict Arnold from Sunday, May 6th, I now see how Lily became involved. It was our insider's way of getting Nina to access me directly without going through anyone else, keeping the insider's fingerprints off the whole thing. Nina's reply. Nina, 7:23 a.m. "You want me to tell the president's daughter?" Unknown caller, 7:28 a.m. "Yes. If you give her the information, she will deliver it straight to her father, and the president will deal with you directly." Nina, 7:34 a.m. "Do you think the president will make this deal with me?" Unknown caller, 7:35 a.m. "Of course he will. Amnesty from your home government in exchange for saving our country? Of course he will. But you will have to go see him. Can you do that? Can you get to the U.S.? Nina, 7:38 a.m. Do I have to see him in person? Unknown caller, 7:41 a.m. Yes, he wouldn't take your word for this over the phone. Nina, 7:45 a.m. I don't know. How do I know he won't ship me to Gitmo and torture me? Unknown caller, 7:48 a.m. He wouldn't. Trust me. The truth is, I don't know what I would have been willing to do to stop this virus. I would have interrogated Nina if I thought it would get me answers. But it never got that far because Nina made it clear, through Lily, and then when she came to see me, that she had a partner who knew the other half of the puzzle. They were a package deal, Nina said, and if I detained her at the White House, I'd never meet the other half of the puzzle, and I'd never be able to stop the virus, which is where we find ourselves now. Nina, 7:54 a.m. If I do this, if I go see his daughter in Paris, how do I know the president will take me seriously? Unknown caller, 7:59 a.m. He will. Nina, 8:02 a.m. Why? You didn't. Unknown caller, 8:04 a.m. Because I'm going to give you a code word that will give you instant credibility. The moment he hears that code, he will take you seriously. No question. Nina, 8:09 a.m. Okay, what is the code? Unknown caller, 8:12 a.m. I have to trust you. This is code word classified information I'm disclosing. I wouldn't just have to resign my position. I'd go to prison. You get that? Nina, 8:15 a.m. Yeah, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning. Unknown caller, 8:17 a.m. Basically, I'm risking everything to help you. I'm trusting you. Nina, 8:22 a.m. We have to trust each other. I won't ever tell anyone who you are or what you told me. Swear to God. Unknown caller, 9:01 a.m. All right, I'm taking the risk of my life right now. I hope you understand that. I hope I can trust you. Nina, 9:05 a.m. I do. You can. So that's how Nina learned Dark Ages. And the day after this exchange of text messages, just 5 days ago, this past Monday, Nina found Lily in Paris at the Sorbonne and whispered Dark Ages in her ear. Lily called me, and I've spent the last 4-plus days trying to figure out who the insider is. So far, I'm no closer to knowing that. I scroll down to the next page. Mr. President? The voice of Casey calling to me. We're ready! I rush out of the communications room, Alex following me, and find Casey, Devin, and Augie in the war room. Ready to activate the virus, I say. I put down my phone on a desk and stand behind Devin. Casey turns to me. Mr. President, before we do this, you understand that we don't know whether the virus is communicating between devices. It's possible that each virus on each device around the country is independently timed to go off. But it's also possible that the virus on one computer will signal to the others that it will send an execute command to set off the virus simultaneously on all affected devices. Yes, you said that before. My point being, sir, I hope this works. But if it doesn't, and the virus detonates on the Pentagon server, it might activate on the millions and probably billions of devices around the country. Our worst-case scenario will come true if our plan doesn't work. It worked on the trial run, I say. Yes, it did. We've done our best to reverse engineer the virus for our trials, but I cannot tell you with 100% certainty that our recreation was perfect. We've only had hours to do this, working quickly. So I can't tell you this will work on the real virus. I take a deep breath. If we do nothing, this virus will go off soon anyway, I say. Maybe a minute from now, maybe a few hours at most, but it's coming soon. And this scheme we devised is the closest thing we've come up with to stop the virus, right? Yes, sir. It's the only thing that's even remotely succeeded. So, I shrug, do you have a better idea? I don't, sir. I just want you to understand, if this doesn't work, everything could go to shit. I get it. This could be a big win for us, or it could be Armageddon. I look at Augie. What do you think, Augie?
I agree with your reasoning, Mr. President. This is our best bet. Our only bet.
Casey? I agree. We should try it. Devon. Agreed, sir. I rub my hands together. Let's do it, then. Devon's fingers hover over the keyboard. Here goes. What? Alex Tribble, standing near me, jumps as he puts his finger against his earbud. North Route has been breached? Viper! He yells into his radio. Viper! Do you copy, Viper? In one fluid motion, Alex is on me, gripping my arm and pulling me. In the communications room, Mr. President. We need to lock down. It's the safest. No, I'm staying here. Alex tugs on me, not relenting. No, sir. You have to come with me right now. Then they're coming with, I say. Fine, but let's go. Devon unhooks the laptop. Everyone rushes to the communications room. Just as the sound of heavy gunfire echoes in the distance.
Chapter 100. After barreling the white van through the barricade, Lord Six slows it almost to a complete stop as he searches for the unmarked dirt road. There, he missed it. He stops, throws the van in reverse, backs up past the road, and makes the left turn. If he hadn't been told it was there, he would have missed it altogether. The path is narrow enough to accommodate only a single vehicle, and it's dark, the falling sun completely shrouded by the tall trees on each side. Lodge Sick grips the steering wheel and cranes his neck forward, unable to gain too much speed on the uneven terrain, but slowly accelerating. Only a half mile until they reach the cabin.
On the lake, a firefight. Team 2 fires smoke grenades and batters the Secret Service boat with rounds from the AK-74s. The boat returns machine gun fire, forcing the attackers down to the deck, using the hull of their boat as a bunker. The few remaining Secret Service agents are on foot, covering the backyard. They scramble toward the dock, raising their weapons and opening fire on Team 2's boat as well. Once the agents on foot reach the dock, their attention fully trained on the attack boat, Bach rushes along the perimeter of the yard, covered by the darkness and distraction, and jumps into the window well in front of the basement laundry room.
Chapter 101. Alex Tremble shuts and locks the heavy door to the communications room. He removes the phone from his pocket and clicks it on. Devon sits in the chair, laptop open, ready to go. Go, Devon, I say. Activate the virus. I look over Alex's shoulder at his phone. The Secret Service installed cameras on the roof, and Alex and I watch the feed from the camera facing north, a white van barreling down the dirt path toward us. Where are you, Viper? Alex cries into his radio. As if responding to a stage director's cue, a Marine helicopter, part of a new fleet of Viper attack helicopters, appears out of nowhere, swooping down as it closes on the van from behind. A Hellfire air-to-surface missile launches from its wing, spiraling toward the van. The van explodes, a ball of orange flame bouncing end over end before coming to rest on its side. Secret Service agents shuffle forward, automatic weapons poised. The screen changes as Alex clicks a button. We are looking to the southeast, watching a firefight on the lake, agents on a boat, and agents on the dock firing at another boat, trying desperately to keep it from reaching shore. Alex, a finger pressed to the earbud in his ear, calls into his radio. Navigator, clear path! Clear path! All agents stand clear for Viper! With that, the Secret Service boat reverses course, backing away from the attack boat, and the agents on the dock scramble back to ground and dive to the earth. The Viper arrives, firing another Hellfire and completely incinerating the attack boat, a ball of flame along with a fountain of lake water. The Secret Service boat capsizes too. Now drop me a perimeter of Marines, Alex calls out into his radio, immediately moving to the next phase. The Marines stationed at the local airport with the Viper were his idea, letting us keep a low profile at the cabin, as I insisted, but keeping some heavy backup nearby. The agent's in the water, I say to Alex, pushing his shoulder. He lowers his radio. They have life preservers. They're okay. Back to his radio. Where are my Marines? And I need a casualty report. Okay, the virus is activated on the Pentagon service, says Devon. My head on a swivel. I focus on Devon as Alex moves to the door of the communications room and continues to shout instructions. Let's see if this works. Devon releases a breath. Say a prayer. He types on the computer. We don't have the smart screen now, huddled as we are in the communications room, so I watch over his shoulder along with Casey and Augie as he pulls up the file properties to see if the marked as deleted files will survive. That's a zero, I say, looking at the bottom row of the properties box. A zero's bad, right? It's... No, it's overwriting the files. You deleted them, I ask. You marked them as del... Yes. David grabs the laptop in frustration. Shit. I watch the same file properties, the boxes of descending rows of words and numbers, but seeing the zero in the bottom rows. Why isn't it working, I ask. What?
We must not have completely reconstructed the virus in our tests, says Augie. The parts that we could not decrypt.
We missed something, Casey says. My blood goes cold. The Pentagon server's going to be erased? Casey raises a hand to her ear, her earpiece. Repeat, she says, closing her eyes in concentration. Are you sure?
What, Casey?
She turns to me. Mr. President, our team at the Pentagon, they're saying the virus we just activated issued an execute command throughout the system. The virus is detonating at Treasury, she taps her ear, Homeland Security, Transportation, everywhere, sir. She looks at her smartphone. My phone, too.
I reach for my phone. Where's my phone?
Oh, no, says Augie. Oh, no.
My phone, too, says Devin. It's happening. Jesus, it's going off everywhere. The virus is attacking everywhere.
Casey falls to a crouch, gripping her hair.
It's happening, she says. God help us.
For a moment, I am stunned, in disbelief. Deep down, I always believed that somehow, in some way, it would never happen, that we'd figure something out. God help us. He's right. Dark Ages has arrived.
Chapter 102. The private jet lands on a narrow runway outside of Zagreb. Suleiman Jendoruk stretches, gets up, and takes the stairs down onto the tarmac. Two men greet him, each with a rifle slung over his shoulder. Tall, dark men with no expressions other than respectful acknowledgments to Suli. He follows them to a jeep. They get in the front and he gets in the back. Soon they are driving on a two-lane road parallel to the magnificent Mount Medvednica, so majestic in its... He jumps at the sound of the ringtone on his phone, a ringtone he's been expecting, the sound of a bomb exploding, the ringtone he reserved for just one event. It's early, by a few hours. The Americans must have tried to delete it. He pulls it up on his phone and reads the delicious words, "Virus activated." He closes his eyes and lets the warmth of satisfaction spread through him. There is nothing so sexy as a good destructive overwrite, the power he can deploy from a keyboard 1,000 miles away. As the jeep continues onward, the wind blowing his hair back, he savors the rush. He did this. One man who changed the course of history. One man who brought the world's only superpower to its knees. One man who will soon be rich enough to enjoy it.
Chapter 103.
This can't be right. No, God, no.
Panic, cursing, wailing all around me. My body trembling, still in a suspended state of disbelief, waiting to awaken from the nightmare, I moved to the computer in the communications room, secured by a separate line that Dark Ages can't touch. We've moved to the threat mitigation phase. I need to get hold of Carolyn. First, get word to the congressional leaders. Bring the House and Senate in as soon as possible to pass legislation authorizing the nationwide use of military in our streets, the suspension of habeas corpus, wide-ranging executive authority to impose price controls and rationing. Second, file the executive orders.
Wait, what? Devin cries out.
Wait, Casey, look at this. She rushes to his side. I do too. Devin works the computer, some kind of accelerated scrolling, jumping from one set of files to another. I don't get it. It what? I shout, speak! It, Devin types on the computer, various screens appearing and disappearing. It overwrote a few files like it was trying to show us it could, but now it stopped. It stopped. The virus stopped. Casey angles past me, peering at the computer screen.
What is that? She asks.
Chapter 104. Bach stands in the window well as the gunfight rages on the lake. Team 1, status, she says, awaiting word from Lodzsik, the Czech team leader.
We are proceeding. What?
Team 1, status, she hisses, trying to keep her voice down.
Helikoptera,
Lodzsik cries in his native tongue.
Odkud pokazi helikoptera?
A helicopter? Team 1. She hears the explosion in stereo, coming from the north and from her earbuds via Lodzsik's transmitter. She looks to the north, the flames coloring the sky. An attack helicopter? Something inside her sinks. She tries the window into the laundry room. Locked.
Yibiga,
she hisses, feeling a trickle of panic. She holds her sidearm by the suppressor, leans in toward the window.
Ularning Vertolius Laribor!
Hamid, the Team 2 leader, shouts into her earbud. She doesn't speak Uzbek, but she has a feeling.
They have helicopter! They...
The explosion is even louder this time. A massive eruption from the direction of the lake, pummeling her eardrum through the earbud as well, causing her a moment of imbalance. It is unfamiliar, the fear blossoming inside her, raising her temperature, fluttering through her stomach. Not since Sarajevo has she truly felt afraid of anything or anyone. She hadn't realized she was still capable of it. She flicks the gun's handle against the window, shattering the glass. She reaches in and unlocks the latch, waits for any reaction to the breaking glass from inside, her standard precaution. 5 seconds. 10 seconds. No sound. She pushes open the window and slides into the laundry room, feet first.
Chapter 105. What? I ask. Tell me what's happening. Devin shakes his head. Nina put a circuit breaker in. A what? She put a stopper in and installed a password override. What the hell is going on, people? Augie touches my arm.
Apparently, he says, his voice panicky, Nina installed a mechanism that suspended the virus after it began to activate. As Devin said, it began to overwrite a small amount of data to demonstrate its power to do so. But now it is suspended, giving us the opportunity to provide a password to stop it.
We didn't replicate that when we reconstructed the virus, says Casey. We didn't know it was there. What about the viruses on the other computers and devices around the country, I asked. It's talking to them, you said. Are they stopping too? Casey speaks urgently into her headset. Jared, we have a circuit breaker suspending the virus. Are you getting that? You should be getting that. I stare at her waiting. 20 seconds have never passed more slowly. Her face lights up, her hand out like a stop sign. Yes, she says yes. The virus on the Pentagon server must have sent out a suspend command throughout the distributive system. So, the virus is suspended everywhere.
Yes, sir. We have new life.
Let me see this password override circuit breaker thing. I move Augie aside and look at the computer screen. Enter keyword. 28 minutes, 47 seconds. The clock, I note, it's counting down from what? 30 minutes? 28:41, 28:33, 28:28. So the virus is in suspension for 28 minutes and change?
Yes, says Augie. We have 28 minutes remaining to enter the keyword, or the virus activates in full across the entire system of devices.
You've got to be kidding me, I say, gripping my hair. No, this is good. This is good. We're still in the game. One last chance. Okay, a keyword. I turn to Casey. Don't we have software that can decode passwords?
Well, yes, but not that we can install and operate in 28 minutes, especially with this virus. It would take hours, more likely days or weeks.
Okay, then we have to guess. We have to guess.
Simple, Nina had said in her text message when she said she could explain how to stop the virus. You don't need to be an expert, she said. Simple. Simple if you know the keyword.
What the hell is the keyword? I turned to Augie. She's never mentioned anything?
I did not know of this at all, he says. I can only guess it was her way of protecting me, keeping our knowledge separate.
But maybe she said something to you, like, in hindsight, she was giving you a clue. Think, Augie. Think!
Augie puts his hand on his forehead. I try to think of anything Nina might have said to me in the Oval Office. She talked about the country burning, about being a package deal with Augie. She gave me a ticket to the Nationals game, the helicopter in Dubai. It could be anything.
Type Suleiman, I tell Devin. He types in the word and hits enter. The word disappears. Enter keyword, 27 minutes, 46 seconds.
Use all caps, says Casey. It might be case sensitive.
Devin does nothing.
All lowercase.
Nope. Type his whole name, Suleiman Jindorik, I say. Devin types it. No response.
Jesus, how are we supposed to do this? I say.
Simple, Nina said in the text message. I pat my pockets. I look around the room. Where's my phone? Where the hell's my phone?
Try Nina, says Augie.
Nope. Not in all caps either, says Devin after trying both. Not in all lowercase.
Try Nina Shinkuba, all the different ways.
How do you spell Shinkuba? Everyone looks at Augie, who shrugs.
I never knew her last name until you told me, he says to me.
I never saw it written. Liz gave me the information. I need to call her. I pat my pockets again, look around the room. Where's my phone?
Probably Shinkuba, says Casey.
Devin tries it a number of ways. Nina Shinkuba, two words. Nina Shinkuba, two words, all lowercase. Nina Shinkuba, two words, all uppercase. Nina Shinkuba, one word, all uppercase. Nina Shinkuba, all lowercase. No luck. I look at the timer. 26:35. Where the hell is my phone? I say again. Has anyone? Then I remember, I left my phone in the war room. I set it down while Devin was about to activate the virus. When Alex got word of the attack outside and hustled us into the communications room, I forgot it. I'll be right back, I say. Alex, still on his radio, still monitoring things outside, sees my movement and rushes to block the door.
No, sir. We're in lockdown. We don't have the all clear.
My phone, Alex. I need it.
No, sir, Mr. President.
I grab his shirt, surprising him. I'm giving you a direct order, agent. That phone is more important than my life.
Then I'll get it, he says.
He reaches into his pocket. Then go, Alex. Go. One moment, sir, he says. We're moving something from his pocket. Keep trying, I yell to my team. Try Augie's name. Augie Kozlenko.
Chapter 106. Bach, sitting atop the stackable washer and dryer, pushes herself off and drops quietly to the floor of the dark room. She looks through the doorway. As she'd been told, the basement is not some maze of rooms, but rather one long hallway with several rooms on each side and a staircase in the middle of the hallway on her left. Behind her, from the open window, she hears something outside. The thump of a vessel landing. The commotion of commands being shouted, feet stomping the ground, men fanning out. The helicopter again. Marines arriving, maybe special forces. Footfalls. They are running toward the open window. She squats down, raising her weapon. The men rush past and stop. One of them stops right near the window. What are they? Then she hears a voice.
West team in position.
West team.
This is the west side of the cabin. The west team. There are presumably north, south, and east teams, too. They have surrounded the perimeter.